Well, I think we're all sleepy now. I'm sleepy. We can do a sleepy meditation. I can't, but you can. Maybe we'll just take a second just to get into our bodies again. Well, I hope we didn't get out of our bodies, otherwise we'd be dead. So, more into our bodies, I should say. Just take a few seconds. A few minutes. Just reflecting on what we talked about this morning, practices we did. You can refresh yourself with the base breath if you want. Remember what we did. Or just find your root in your body. Coming home again. With a lot of gentleness, openness, acceptance of whatever is going on. So, is there any questions just from this morning before we jump into kind of the afternoon topics? Is there anything you guys were thinking about during lunch? Or? You guys got it? Yeah.
I don't forget the chant. I forgot what the paramedics are.
Oh, okay. So the paramedics, that would be in the Mayana path, yeah? So the paramedics are six. So generosity, patience, ethics, concentration, wisdom, joyous perseverance. But I got the wrong order.
In Theravada Buddhism, they're called the paramedics, and there are 10 of them. And they're just expanded on that. I won't know them all by heart. They're generosity, patience, renunciation, metta is one of them. Do you remember? They're qualities.
Generosity
and metta.
Did you say that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But they're qualities, and it's just another path. It's another way to practice. You practice developing those qualities.
Yeah.
Did I mention the renunciation thing? Is that going to be part of the talk?
I can leave. We can talk about it.
Okay. Yeah. What I was talking with him before the lunch was when we were talking about suffering and Buddhism and the path, and I thought, well, what if I want to go on a cruise, or what if I want to do something that I enjoy, and then I'm going to come back, and then I'm going to be, oh my gosh. So is the path about going on a vacation and knowing that that's not the ultimate happiness.
Yeah.
And you were saying that, you know, we can do all these things, but it's knowing, and that's what renunciation is.
Yeah, so I'm not going to really talk too much about renunciation today, because I think it's better to have this as a base, and then we can, actually renunciation is usually something taught first. That's like the beginning of the path, you know? And so, but I think it's really helpful to have some sort of healthy emotional base, and then also some idea of calm abiding practice and emptiness. Then renunciation can come in a really healthy way. But generally, I think for most of us practitioners, what's your name again?
Barbara.
What we were talking about was, you know, often we have this idea of renunciation, not Barbara, but just this is what I was telling Barbara, it made me think of, and I wanted to bring it up to everyone, that, you know, it's something where I have to give up everything, you know, and I have to just be really simple and sort of, you know, and yes, in a way that helps. But actually, even if you did all that, it doesn't mean you've renounced samsara, right? So, but that also doesn't mean you can have your cake and eat it too. So some people say, oh, especially Tibetan Buddhists, they like to say, oh, I'm a Tibetan Buddhist, I can have everything, you know, and like have all my cake and eat it too, and, you know? So it's becomes a bit fooling yourself, you know? I think Theravada is a little bit more, honest sometimes with that. So, but again, I'm sort of joking, right? It depends on the practitioner. Obviously, the Tibetan Buddhist path has genuine renunciation in it, and there are practitioners who are doing that. But this genuine renunciation, there's like a path type of renunciation, and then there's sort of a result. You know, within all practices, there's a way of explaining them from ground, path, and fruition. I'm not going to get into that today so much, but I'll just talk, you know, more or less, you have this path renunciation, and then you have a fruition renunciation, or the result. So the fruition renunciation, it's someone who has high realizations, and they're able to actually not have attachment when they're engaging with objects. And they're able to understand the reality of them, and therefore they don't have to be engaging with them in this graspy sort of way, or aversion towards that object. So, but for most of us, this a path kind of renunciation and a more realistic approach is seeing the futility of an object that's not, or whatever emotion or process we're going through, and really investigating it until we're able to differentiate, is this the futility of that, meaning the, is this going to cause me a genuine, long-lasting, true happiness, or just a temporary happiness? And then the refuge, you know, having to do with, okay, is my refuge going to be in a temporary object that's just going to create some sort of momentary happiness, or is it going to be in an object that is going to be more long-lasting? So, but the trick is, this is what Santa Barbara, it doesn't mean you have to then, like, never eat chocolate, you know? But again, it depends what level of the path you're you know. That's why we have a monastic tradition, because obviously we're not engaging in certain behavior as a result of trying to form renunciation. Because you're a monk, it doesn't mean you're renounced. Trust me, I can tell you that. It just means I'm using it as a method to try to develop renunciation. Similarly, if you're a householder practitioner, yogini, you have to use methods also to create renunciation. But, you know, you can still enjoy things, but the renunciation means you're not looking to that for your ultimate happiness. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So it's really specific. Otherwise, we could drive ourselves crazy with, like, you know, oh, and just beat ourselves up so much. Trust me, I do it a lot. You know? Just beat ourselves up, you know, oh, I should be doing this, I should be on. Yeah, someone mentioned earlier how to work with this idea of feeling guilty, right? Not being on the cushion. I forgot someone mentioned that.
Yeah.
Something, yeah. So that's how, you know? You know, okay, and then actually the renunciation comes naturally, because the more we're using our analysis and logical cognitive side of our mind and emotional intelligence to discern between, okay, is this sort of behavior, object, whatever, going to create an ultimate form of happiness for me? The more we become clear about that, the more we can actually enjoy it, just enjoy it. And it doesn't have to, as long as it's not creating direct non-virtue, right? So, let me finish this, the thought. So then, you know, I'm just saying this in a more general way, right? There'd be more specific ways of talking about renunciation. Because, of course, if you engage in behavior or something that's not creating happiness, you could say, okay, well, that's creating some sort of suffering. But again, I think what I'm trying to say is it doesn't have to be so black and white, where the objects themselves do not have any quality. You know, they don't have the quality necessarily of saying, okay, this is definitely going to create suffering for you. A lot of it has to do with the way we're interacting with things, you see? And so then a genuine renunciation can really come, because then from deep down in our inner wisdom, from our really like a pure nature, you could kind of say, I'm going to talk more about this later on, then what can happen is naturally renunciation starts to come, because we just start to see the futility. Mm. And then we don't want to engage with certain behaviors. You see what I'm saying? And we just eat the chocolate and say, oh, nice, you know, and really enjoy the chocolate, but then we're not, oh, I need another one. Or the chocolate disappointed us because it was 70% dark instead of 60%. Whatever the issue is, right? So you see what I'm saying? So renunciation is a very interesting little thing.
Here. Well, I was just going to say, I think without that chance, you can get attached to deprivation.
Yes, definitely, yeah. Or you can have a lot of pride. You know, there's certain. The Buddha said, you know, any monk who has pride thinks he's better than other people because he's a monk. He's not a monk. You know, so this is very, very tricky areas. You know, anyways, we were talking about it. I thought it was nice to mention as a group. Anyone else? Yeah.
Thinking about emotion during lunch and the good conversation I had, and I think often I'm, you know, when I get carried away with emotion or get into circular thinking, when I step out of it, I'm often in a discernment process about, you know, the other people involved, the organizations involved, or this relationship between, you know, being aware of your emotions, but also often needing to take action around your emotions.
Yes,
I'm wondering if you could say things about that discernment process.
That's really good. So this is what we call the dance of the relative and ultimate in Buddha Dharma. Yeah.
That's an awesome name.
Yeah, I didn't come up with it. It's so mutated. I'm doing a lot of things from him, obviously. He's really good at this kind of realm. Well, a lot of other realms of Dharma, too. But, so we're going to talk about ultimate truth a little bit. We'll talk about emptiness, not this teaching, but the next one, if hopefully we'll have time. But basically, this is really tricky because, in essence, we have to relate with our own experience and then the experience we're having in relation to whatever kind of outer object or inner object, any kind of phenomenon. And I think as a Buddha Dharma practitioner or just a meditator, we have to take responsibility for what's appearing to us. You see what I'm saying? In the sense of recognizing this is an appearance I'm having, you see? But at the same time, there are other sentient beings, you know? There are other sentient beings that we have to interact with and who are affected by our behavior and our speech, right? So sometimes you have to take action or non-action, right? Whatever the case may be. So this is quite difficult. I think this takes a lot of intuitive wisdom, and I think I will say as a beginner, myself included in this, I would say more than most of the time, I'm going to say percentage, but most of the time, most situations require us to do, just sit with ourselves. You know what I mean? You don't have to go somewhere special and do it. You just sit with the emotion in that instant, you know? And they often require us to sort of take ourselves out of the situation sometimes, you know? So sometimes if you're in a situation, you have to do your best to react with wisdom. But that's where sort of this side of Dharma practice, which I'm going to talk about in the afternoon, really helps, which is, the word analysis gets a really bad rap in Buddhism in the West, so I need to find a better word, but generally they call this kind of meditation analytical meditation. So it's actually using the cognitive to change the thought processes we're having into virtuous type thoughts or helpful thoughts. That and more this resting kind of meditation in more not where we're not thinking, where we're just resting the body or calm abiding practice on the breath or something like this, they really help each other. See? So these work in tandem. And often the analytical meditations is what help our reactions when we're just face to face with it. You see? But again, like I said, I think it's really helpful where we have to sometimes take ourselves out of a situation if we can. Really look on what's my projection here? What's my appearance? How is this relating to my habitual pattern? But we don't have to think so much, you see? I think oftentimes, at that time, we don't need an analysis. Like when the emotion's really strong, we need to use the methods I was saying earlier. Rest in the body, really give a lot of space, give a lot of kindness to the emotion to be what it is, you see? And then, that's actually dealing with the relative. That's the relative aspect, or what they call relative truth. Do any of you know what the two truths are? The two truths sort of model? A few people? Okay, I'll explain it later. It's mostly in Tibetan Buddhism. So, but you have these two truths of relative truth and ultimate truth. Relative truth being the appearance that appears to us, and ultimate truth being the reality of that appearance. Mm-hmm. But actually, in essence, they're the same. They're two sides of the same coin. So it's a little bit tricky. So we're going to get a little more cognitive this afternoon. I apologize, but I have to in order to explain it. So with the two sides of this same coin, you always have this projection and this appearance we're working with. So that's the relative. You have to give it, like I said, it's real, it's happening, but then the ultimate side, it's not true. See? It doesn't mean that this person isn't, like I'm just going to say a situation, like let's say it's a person who's affronting us or something like that. It doesn't mean that this person doesn't have an issue and is, you know, either something we did or it's their projection happening. It doesn't mean that's not true. It just means that there's so many aspects and conditions happening in order to make this situation. So if we sit back and really learn and gain a lot of wisdom and knowledge in our emotional state, and then when we react, there's going to be a much more likelihood that that reaction is going to come out of compassion. And it's going to come out of something that's a little bit more close to reality. Does that make sense?
It does.
So this is this dance of relative and ultimate. It's something is real in the sense of relatively, you know, there is a floor that I can stand and walk on. But there's no true floor. This is the very difficult thing in Buddhism. This is something that is very difficult to understand, even more difficult to meditate on. But we have to. This is the Buddha's ultimate teaching, the thing that differentiates Buddha Dharma from anything else, not saying it's better than anything else, it's just what differentiates it, is this teaching of the Buddha. Yeah? On emptiness. So, and this is what actually cuts the root of samsara and allows us to attain freedom from samsara. Otherwise, there's really no way to attain, you know, there's no methods can get us to higher states of awareness, higher states of meditation, higher states of bliss and happiness. To actually cut the root, you need this teaching on understanding there is a floor, but this floor does not exist truly, and why. And then really experiencing that in meditation. Of course, who cares about the floor? We have to experience it with our minds and our emotions and these kind of things. Usually floor, something like, we usually use a cup as an example. So they'll just use it as an example. You know, and then you have two ways of, you know, you can apply it to the selflessness of persons, where the Theravada is working with that approach a lot. And in the Mahayana Dharma, they break it out into also selflessness of phenomena. But there's some in the Theravada too. Then. So anyways, this is getting kind of cognitive. I don't want to go too much that route. So, yeah. So in a practical way, really resting, knowing your emotions, gaining more intuitive wisdom. I hate to use the word intuitive, but the only reason I use that is because it's like a knowledge that's not cognitive. And that's really hard for us to... You know what I mean? It's not a conceptual type of knowledge. It is conceptual, but it's not the normal kind of conceptual we're used to. We're used to very gross, conceptualized things. So then this dance of the relative and ultimate, where it's happening, my reaction to this person or situation is as it is, the situation's happening how it is, and we have to react. For instance, like if a car is coming at us, we have to move, right? You wouldn't, if you just stayed there and got hit by the car, you wouldn't really be respecting the relative. Actually, you wouldn't be respecting the ultimate either. Because sometimes when people hear the word emptiness in Buddhism, or shunyata, they think, oh, this means nothing, nothingness. But actually, because of emptiness, things exist. This is very tricky. Anyway, I'm going to get into it later, but I'm just sort of, is that more or less sort of an answer? I don't know, maybe I made it more confusing. Anyone else? Okay. So, I want to talk a little bit about calm abiding practice. So I'm sure a lot of you have a lot of experience with this. Has anyone not done much calm abiding
You want to use another word. Just explain what it is.
Yeah, well, shamatha is the Sanskrit word. In Pali,
samadhi.
You use the word samadhi in Pali.
Concentration practice.
Okay, so you guys have some... Yeah, any kind of vipassana teaching, you're going to hear samadhi teaching, more or less. You know, generally it's taught as... what they call calm abiding with an object, where you're using the breath or something like that as an object of focus for your meditation. This is what, when people say meditation, usually in America, usually people think of that. But actually meditation means a lot of different things. I'm going to go into explaining that a little bit. But I did want to talk about shamatha or calm abiding or samadhi a little bit. And actually, it relates to the first part of our quote from the Dhammapada. We are what we think, and all that we are arises with our thoughts. And also this method of samadhi practice, it's a method that can really help us in the practice that I covered this morning. So, like I said, we need a big tool belt. We need a lot of tools. If we just have like a little, you know, what do you call it? What is this? Like a pocket, you know?
Pocket knife?
Leatherman? A Leatherman?
Well, that would be no. Leatherman's like good. I mean like a, like a dinky like toy.
Screwdriver.
Like a toy screwdriver or something, you know? Like something that, and then we're like, okay, I'm going to meditate, you know? We're kind of a little bit setting us ourselves up for way more obstacles than we need. We're not setting ourselves up for failure, because failure is very, you know, it's subjective. It's, you know what I mean? There's no failure in this. You're talking about multi-lifetimes of, you know, circling. And so in practice that we put in. So it's just a matter of how many obstacles that come up during our practice. And we need lots of tools to be able to deal with them. So samadhi practice is one of those tools, right? And within the Theravada, it's one of the pinnacle tools of it. Same with Tibetan Buddhism, yeah? So in general, I'm going to explain a little bit from the Tibetan lineage, but you're going to see if you studied samadhi and calm abiding practice within the Theravada, it's pretty much the same thing. They have a few different methods that are different, but pretty much the same. So meditation, or in Tibetan they use the word gom. That means meditation in Tibetan. So what this word means from the Tibetan etymology, the Tibetan word gom, it actually means to familiarize yourself with a virtuous object. So here, any kind of meditation we're doing, it often, like I said, sometimes people just think of watching the breath as meditation. But actually, meditation means any kind of familiarization with a virtuous object. This can be with where the mind is focusing on the breath. It can be a visualization. It can be an analytical meditation. There's many, many different kinds of meditation. Walking meditation, obviously, too. So related to this first part of the verse, we are what we think, and all that we are arises with our thoughts. So in Tibetan, the mind is called the king who is responsible for everything, or Kunje Gyalpo. Gyalpo is like king. So the king who is responsible for everything, this is how they sort of describe the mind, yeah? Then the great Guru Rinpoche, one of the figures who brought Buddhism to Tibet from India, he said, do not seek to cut the root of phenomena, cut the root of mind. So this has, and I'm going to explain that later on, but this has a lot of implications with this verse here. So more or less what the Buddha said, we are what we think, and we are, and all that arises is within our thoughts. All that we are is arises with our thoughts. So this is really similar to what this phrase here, the mind being the king who is responsible for everything. Yeah, is this some? I mean, I think Ellie, you can relate to this more or less, right? Mm-hmm. It's not a too far out concept. Right? So then, with that said, if you just say that, okay, that's all good, it's all nice, but if we know that, then that gives us the remedy within that, which is what we have to do is work with the mind, right? And we need as many methods as possible to work with the mind. So shamatha or samadhi practice is one of those. So generally, the word in Tibetan is shining. That's what these. I'm just giving you, you don't have to remember all this. I'm sort of just giving you different synonyms. Just so if you come in contact with the terms in books or anything, you'll have some reference point. So shine is a term in Tibetan. I'm going to use the word calm abiding though when I talk, and this is like samadhi is what you use in the Theravada Sanghas. So then, so more or less the definition of this, of shine practice, is a process of cooling down from a state of mental, emotional, or sensory excitement. So then you can see just by the description of that, when we do this practice, it calms, it's using the mind to cool it down. So then when we're engaging with our emotions, when we're engaging with thought processes, habitual patterns, whether they're karmic or learned in this life, samadhi practice or calm abiding practice, it's going to be a tool to have more control. Yeah? So then within calm abiding practice, there's lots of different objects we can take. So basically, we've decided, okay, so this practice is something that benefits us in the sense where it cools our mind down, so we're able to have more control over our thoughts and emotions, more control in how we react to things, how we view the world. At the same time, so whatever object we're using for that, it all can serve that purpose. So within in the Tibetan tradition, they basically have a calm abiding practice with support and then a calm abiding practice without support. So the calm abiding practice with support, you can have an object of meditation. You can use your breath, and that's perfectly fine. You can also use a visualization. Sometimes they'll use a visualization of the Buddha. So this is where you're using, you know, your mind to actually visualize a figure of the Buddha there. Usually they'll use a statue, and they'll work with that for a while, and then they'll visualize it. Sometimes they'll use an actual visual object. So these are all different ways as objects to use to focus your concentration and stay with that, yeah? So then there's two aspects when we're talking about calm abiding. One is being attentive, or you having mindfulness, and then the other is being alert. So there's many different scholars and great yogis and practitioners throughout all different lineages who have so much different advice on how to engage with these, right? Because it's pretty simple. I mean, you know, you have an object, like let's say the breath, we'll just keep it simple. You have the breath, just focus on the breath and you stay with it. It's very simple in instruction, but difficult, right, to do for a long period of time. But then there's also a lot of instructions. The reason there's a lot of instructions from different masters, from different lineages, is because it's difficult to practice. It's very simple to understand, but very difficult to practice, at least for long periods of time. So this aspect of attentiveness, yeah, or mindfulness, from the way I was taught, this kind of attention, it doesn't have to be, it has to be like 25%. So if we're attentive in the sense of we're just locked into this object and we're focused on it so much, that can actually become an obstacle. And that can actually cause mood disorders, like I was saying. It can also cause sort of a little too much attachment to the samadhi state. So a lot of Tibetan masters actually advise you're keeping your attention on that, but you don't want it too tight. You also don't want it too loose, obviously, right? Then the alertness is this other factor. So you have this attentiveness, which is just merely the remembrance of the object, so the breath, remembering the breath going in, staying, leaving, whatever works for you guys. Some people use the nostrils, right? Some people use the lungs or the whole body, or the whole breath. Depends on the teacher. And then, so there's that aspect of remembrance or attentiveness. Then there's this aspect of alertness. So the alertness is another faculty of mind. So while 25% of the mind is sort of, again, I'm giving sort of the cognitive approach right now, but we're going to do it, so don't worry. I'm just giving you an overview. You don't have to take this on. So then the other aspect is this alertness. So the alertness is an aspect of the mind, which is then watching out, is the mind getting distracted? Is it getting too loose? Is it getting too tight? Basically looking for dullness and excitement. So you have these two aspects, mindfulness or attentiveness. I'm using those synonymously. And then alertness. Yeah? Does that make sense? So then the alertness would also be the faculty of mind that when we do get distracted and we're, you know, building our dream home, you know, in our meditation session. Or usually me, it's food. Or whatever. You know, thinking about lunch or something. The alertness is the faculty of the mind that recognizes that and then brings the mind back to the object. Yeah? It also functions to sort of recognize if we're too tight or too loose. And then there's treatises and pages written on tightness and looseness. So I'm not going to go so much into that today. I don't want to bore you to death. So that's shamatha, or calm binding, with support. Then without support, this is the practice. When we do our practice session, I think you guys can choose what you want to do. But if you've never done shamatha without support, I'd like you to try a little bit of it. It's a very, very powerful way to do samadhi practice. I think they call it open awareness in Theravada. Yeah, so you probably already have some experience with it. Yeah. So the reason shamatha without support, it's actually a higher path of samadhi practice. It's in Tibetan Buddhism, usually it's one would start off with, you know, an object like the breath or a visualization, then you would move on to shamatha without support. Within the Dzogchen framework of teachings, so the Nyingma tradition, generally they're going to have you do shamatha or calm abiding without support, because this leads into vipassana very, very easily. So the shamatha without support, when someone has a good experience of that, they're like, they say they're like sort of right on the edge of vipassana. It's right on the edge of it. So this shamatha without support is, you can describe it as being lightly aware of whatever you're experiencing internally or externally, right here and now. So it's just a mere presence. So it's, that's why it's a little bit, they might do calm abiding with an object first before they do objectless calm abiding or without support. Because it's quite difficult to find, okay, well, what am I actually focusing on? With calm abiding without support. And what it is just this mere moment. I'm going to go over this later more, but I'm just giving you an overview now. It's just this mere moment of awareness, and then we're resting on that moment. And that moment is obviously not a moment that you can continue. It's many, many moments, right? Actually, there's in some sutras, I think they break it up, I can't remember, I always forget the number of it. It's like 300 and something. Within a snap, there's like 300 and something moments. So that's what a moment is in Buddhism. Yeah. So then, so the shamatha without support is really just in this moment, and you're abiding in that moment. So it's a little bit more refined. Yeah. So then, what's a specific feature of a calm abiding practice, whether you're using an object or not, is this aspect of, when you have a glass, right? This is an example Tibetans like to use. It's really beautiful. When you have a glass and then, let's say it's mud, there's mud in it, so it's muddy water and it's all mixed up, you know, a clear glass. And then you shake it up, you know, you're going to see mud. But if you let it sit for a certain amount of time, all the mud comes to the bottom and then you have clarity within the glass itself. So this is the process of calm abiding practice. As we sit, we focus on the object. Of course, we gain concentration and we go through the absorption states, right? And then we gain pliancy and all that. That's a goal of shamatha practice. But also it has this goal of we're able to recognize the clarity, the limpidity, and the lucidity and luminosity of the mind itself. And that luminosity then leads on to the vipassana practice within the Tibetan tradition, especially the Dzogchen Mahamudra traditions. And also within the practice I taught this morning, When you have a stable samadhi practice, you're going to have so much more ability to apply that than to whatever difficult emotions are coming up. And actually, samadhi itself will remedy the emotions. This is another remedy. I mean, the gentle vajra breath will help to bring the womb down. But if you practice samadhi a lot and you have a good quality where you're not too tight and not too loose, also the womb will naturally go down. The wind will naturally settle you. That happens with calm abiding practice as well. Yeah. So I'm sure most of you are familiar with posture, but I'm just going to go over it because when we practice together, it's important. So in the Nyingma tradition, they explain these three immovabilities. I'm not going to talk about those because they're a little bit more in the Dzogchen tradition. But here we can talk about the immovable body, right? So you have the 7-point posture within samadhi practice. So the legs are crossed, either in half lotus, full lotus, or I sit like this, which is sometimes called the sattva posture, where you're leg is in front of the other one. Yeah. Is there a name in Pali for this sitting this way?
I forget.
Yeah, I knew it, but I forgot. My brain, yeah, my memory.
I don't know.
If you remember it, you'd say. So the legs are crossed, however's comfortable. You know, you could also sit in a chair, right? The hands are labyrinth. Usually they suggest this kind of posture, where the right palm is right over the left, and you're sitting here within the lap. But also within my Nyingma tradition, they also say your palms can be on your knees like this. That's perfectly fine. Then the spine is straight. The shoulders are back, and sort of, they say, like, spread like a vulture's wings. I think that was in Tibet. Vulture. Yeah. Here, what was it? Like a pigeon? I don't know.
Vulture's good.
Seagull, like a seagull.
A pelican.
Whatever image helps you. Yeah. And then the head and neck, the chin is slightly lowered like this, yeah? Then the mouth is closed but not tight. It's slightly open. And then the tip of the tongue you place on the top of your palate. This helps for focus, and it also helps to keep the saliva from drooling. But I never got so good at this where I would drool. I think you have to be really good at samadhi where you're absorbed quite a bit. So I've never gotten that far. But anyways, so you put your tongue up there. Then usually they'll prescribe that your eyes are during. I'm going to say a few things about the eyes. But normally they would say the eyes are half closed, and then you're gazing at the tip of your nose. So there's they're not completely closed. They're just slightly open, and then you're gazing.
I always have this question: is the tongue behind? Because my palate inside goes. There's the teeth, and then it goes. You know, back, and then it dips up. Mm-hmm. So that's more the roof behind it. So it's not just the flat part right behind the teeth. It's actually behind the teeth that where it goes up.
I'm pretty sure just here.
Oh, yeah. It's just right
it's in the front.
Teeth. Oh, mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it matters. But
no, you could play with it.
It's more relaxing with it behind the teeth than.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of awkward. You might swallow your tongue. So another good question. So then the eyes are gazing. The eyes are slightly open. You can meditate like that. But also in my tradition, we keep the eyes open. So you guys are welcome to try that as well if you want. So the eyes are open, gazing just in front. And then there's sort of a panorama kind of vision. So we're not staring at, you're not staring at something. You're not focusing on something. The focus is like 180 degrees. So there's no sort of object of focus. Now, the reason for this is it allows for the clarity aspect of mind to be triggered more. And then also, this can trigger this, when we practice like this, when we're doing calm abiding practice, it can influence later when we're doing Vipassana practice. In my tradition, when we do Vipassana, we leave our eyes open. Yeah? So, you can do what you want with that. And then also the three-point posture is also taught. This is, the hands are placed on the knees, the spine is straight, and then the eyes are open, gazing slightly up. This is more for Dzogchen practice, but actually you can use it for calm abiding too. So that's the posture. So maybe we'll do a little bit of calm abiding practice. I think a lot of you are familiar with this, but we'll just do a little bit. And then I want to talk about, I'm going to move into talking about Vipassana from the Tibetan style, but I'm going to also talk about how Shamatha supports Vipassana and how they actually cross over. Does that sound good? Yeah? All right, don't fall asleep. No, you can fall asleep if you want. It's a little bit dangerous to do this meditation right after lunch. So just, if you want to sit in a chair or on a cushion, we're not going to go for an incredibly long period of time. Now, whatever's comfortable. The most important thing is that your back is erect, and then if you're sitting in a chair, it's good if you can keep your back full of, there's no obstruction. So sit up, sit in the front of the chair. If you have to, put a pillow. The reason being, our central channel, which runs, like I talked earlier, in front of our spine, when you lay back, it sort of suppresses it a little bit. It's good to sit up. So So maybe we'll start with calm abiding with an object, so you can choose your breath. I think we'll just go with that. So even though we're focusing on an object, our breath, we also need an incredible amount of relaxation from this meditation. But if we lose the object, with our alertness, we just bring the mind back really gently. Usually it's quite easy to tell if dullness is happening, but tightness sometimes is difficult due to the cultural reasons I was saying earlier. We're so used to being tight. So you might want to start this meditation by just resting in the body, then slowly move to recognizing your inhalations and exhalations. Falling asleep, you can open your eyes more. I said you're keeping 25% of your focus on your breath. Just merely being aware of the inhalation and exhalation. We don't have to shut off our sense faculties either. Merely being aware that there's a sound, feeling, sight, smell, sensation. Merely being aware of them does not necessarily mean we become distracted. we're going to do a little bit of combining without support now. Sometimes it's tough to actually start with an object like a breath and then attempting to go into without support. For common biting without support, you can choose to keep your eyes open or closed, but you don't want them closed completely. You want them a little bit open if you're staring at the tip of your nose. But you might want to try just having them open, your gaze slightly raised in this kind of 180 degree view. You're not focusing on any object in particular, but your vision is also not blurry. So we're merely going to focus on the present moment. This includes all sensations, sounds, thoughts. But when we lose the object, we still have that alertness to bring us back to the object, which is the present moment. Blink your eyes, just blink. Be aware of the blinking, whatever sounds, thoughts, sensations. But we're not losing this 25% focus on the nowness. If we lose it, it's okay. We just gently bring our attention back. What's beautiful about objectless samatha, or open awareness meditation, is we don't have to reject anything that's happening in our experience. Whatever sounds, sights, thoughts, they're all welcome to pass through. There's no cocoon we're trying to create here. It's very challenging to stay with the nowness. Thoughts are always leading us into the future, into past events. But we have to just recognize those are part of the nowness as well. As soon as we're carried off by them, we're not in the nowness, we're distracted. But just the occurrence of the thought, happening within the nowness of this moment. As we engage with this meditation, spaciousness can come out of us. Also clarity. That spaciousness, we have more ability to handshake our emotions and thoughts, understand our emotional patterns or thought patterns, slowly there's a space that comes in between us and our pattern. the gap that comes. This offers us a choice. Gaze of the eyes can help us with our dullness or excitement. If we're experiencing dullness, we can open our eyes and raise our gaze higher. If we're experiencing excitement, we can lower our gaze. Shake the body or do something vigorous. Counter dullness if it's really heavy. Because we have consciousness, we have mind, all phenomena are able to appear. Here we're just resting in that clarity aspect of mind, the ability to have knowing. Their cognizance. Yeah. I'm going to teach you guys a little bit of, I don't know the official name, but I call it the yogi shake, and it helps to sort of wake you up. So it helps with dullness a lot. So you can watch me, and then we'll do it together. So basically, you're moving your shoulders, and then you're... In Tibetan Buddhism, they expel certain syllables that help expel stale lung, like stale, not stale lung, but like help to change the subtle body a little bit, to freshen it up. So sometimes they say hum, sometimes they say ha, so this one is ha. So as you're shaking, I'll do it first, and then, so it's a little bit like, it looks a little funny. I'm laughing at myself. And then you're shaking like this, yeah. So you say, and then shoulder shake. Like this. Yeah. And you really feel your body kind of, your chi kind of, you know? Yeah. I don't know, I should learn the name of that.
We call it the yogi shake.
You think Tibetan yogis will do that? Feels good, yeah?
Yeah.
So maybe we'll take a short break and then, back. Yeah.
We can talk about the experience. Of
sure.
The,
yeah. Yeah. If you want to, maybe we'll. Yeah, we'll have a short break and we'll talk about it. So, if you guys have any questions from the, I want to do a small group again, but I want to do it after the next sort of lecture a little bit, because I think there'll be more than to discuss, and we only got about a little less than an hour and a half more. So, if there's any questions, we can do now. Yeah.
In the meditation in the presence, I find I'm overwhelmed.
Yeah.
And what I tend to do is vacillate wildly between a sensory presence and an emotional presence.
Yeah.
I'm feeling things sensorily, but also I get between the two of them.
It's all of the above. So the nowness is everything. Yeah. So the sensory experience, the thoughts, emotions, all included. But what's difficult is to rest on the nowness, which is the clarity, sort of experiencing those.
Yes.
It's actually quite difficult to find the object of meditation. You know, usually it takes a lot of time just sitting there, finding, okay, well, what am I actually resting on here? Because the clarity where you're resting on is very subtle. We're not used to resting on the clarity of the mind, that kind of cognizance of the mind, we're used to resting on the emotion or the thought or the sensation, you know, right? Which is fine, that would be another objective. Yeah.
So you're saying in a way the object is awareness itself.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, so just keep trying. I'm with you, dude. Yeah, I'm there in the trenches with you, so. Yeah. You know, I mean, like I said, I think the breath is a perfectly fine object, so you can keep going back to that, and then do these short moments of dropping. What happens, I notice, is if we start with the breath, sometimes it's hard to get away from that, because we're so used to that, and then often when I do that, I'm like, and then I try to go to open awareness meditation or open presence, then I'm like, oh, I'm meditating on the breath again, you know, so it's tricky. Yeah.
I found doing open awareness outside in nature.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes.
It's very nice.
I don't know. It feels just right.
Yeah, I think that can be a really good support. I mean, nature is sort of becoming also a rare commodity in our culture. Slowly, you know. I mean, we're really blessed here in California. So, you know, we all have a lot of awareness in nature and relationship with it, but a lot of people don't in the world and country. So the ground itself, this is sort of my opinion and sort of a little bit of experience, but the nature itself acts as a support for creating more emotional health, also it can for calm abiding practice. I mean, that's why you have all these images of monks and forests and things like that, you know. You know, in a way there's like it's a little bit like spiritual materialism, sort of like we look at these images and think, oh, I have to be like that, or I have to cut off everything. No, I think the image is showing you, no, practically it just works good like that. You know, you go off in a cave There's nothing to do but meditate. So you're out of pure boredom. I mean, that's how when I was on retreat near Big Sur, just out of sheer boredom, nothing else to do, I'll just read this Dharma book, you know? I know that sounds bad, but actually it works, you know? But anyway, yeah, you're right. Nature is a huge support.
So, I had a question. So she was meditating, and it was very, very pleasant. And with her eyes closed, she saw first this very big star.
Yeah, 2 months ago, first time, I saw, just 1 second, mm-hmm. a little piece upon my eyes. I see one star, really big.
Mm-hmm.
Big star.
Mm-hmm.
One star, really big. I don't know what is good.
I don't know if it's good or bad. I think whatever happens sort of in meditation, you know, just let it go.
Cool.
You know, just be like, oh, that's interesting, you know, and then be like, okay, and then keep going with the meditation, because the main focus in this kind of meditation, I don't know what you were doing, but the main focus is the samadhi meditation. It's sort of either the breath is an object, or like we were just doing like nowness, right? So shamatha without support. So then I think whatever comes, it just comes, you know. Sometimes things will come, different people, according to like how our bodies are, you know, our subtle body. So sometimes different, maybe if our eyes are closed, like an image or something like that, or the advice is always just don't worry, you know, just keep going.
And then last month I see a lot of stars, 1 day, 2 day stars.
Oh yeah?
Yeah, just 1 second, not long, it's really beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, yeah, that's good.
It's good.
I don't know if it's good or bad. You know?
but really beautiful. What's time? I want to see again, but it's no more.
Yeah. I think, don't worry too much. If it comes, then just be like, oh, okay. Actually, I think it's better if you don't get attached to that kind of thing. You know? Don't think like it's special.
I don't think.
No. Just keep going. I mean, at least with this, if this is the meditation you're doing, the main thing is to gain more stability with the concentration. Right? Depends what kind of meditation.
I focus my breath. Inhale, exhale, inhale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, then I think you didn't feel dizzy or anything like that?
No, just feel the peace. I sit for 1 hour.
Mm.
Yeah, when I sit long time, sometimes I see that. And sometimes when I breathe peace, sit for 1 hour, 2 hours, I fall asleep my mind goes somewhere. I just really short time, happen many times.
Mm-hmm.
I see, I talk with somebody I don't know. It just 1 second.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what that. Mm-hmm. You too?
Yeah.
And then my mind goes somewhere, I see somebody I don't know. It's just like a dream.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. When I wake, I know, oh, what this?
Mm-hmm.
Many times.
Yeah, I think, don't worry too much. Just keep going in the meditation. Yeah.
Your first time it happened, nobody's scared.
Yeah.
Long time ago, nobody was scared. I opened the eye, what is scary?
Right now,
I'm learning, I'm not scared.
No, I don't think so. I've had the experience too. You were saying you felt like you kind of dropped for a second, you know?
Yes.
Almost like asleep.
Yeah.
That's happened to me too. I think there's actually a word for it. Banga. I think that. Yeah, when you kind
something
of drop below consciousness.
Metabolically is going on. It happens to me, I'm sure, because I know physically there's something going on metabolically.
Mm-hmm.
It changes for 2 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think usually master's advice is just keep going, you know. Actually, with samadhi practice, like, once you get stability where you're going through the 9 stages of shamatha or samadhi into the absorptions happen later, but all kinds of things can happen. Yeah.
And just to say that, you know, there is an experience of dropping like that without losing consciousness, and so that's a little bit different, I think, than feeling like you've just fallen asleep for a second.
But don't focus too much. Those can be obstacles to meditation if you focus on them.
I don't understand.
Like, they can distract you from what the purpose of the meditation is. Because you get too, oh wow, this is amazing, and then you want to, whatever is experiencing.
Oh.
And then, you know, like for instance, I was really into, this is a totally different kind of meditation, so it's hard to judge it with this, but some Hindu meditation where you're trying to find a third eye, you know. I don't think it was my third eye, it's just like if you look at a light long enough, and then you close your eyes, you're going to see like a big ball. And I got really excited about that, you know.
Oh.
And And before I was in Buddhism, I was doing some of that technique, and you know, didn't really help. You know,
right.
It just was a distraction. And usually, it's not whatever comes. You just keep doing the practice. Yeah, don't get too excited. But if you get ill, that's a different thing. Then you have to see somebody. You know? If it's causing a problem, like an illness, sick. If you're getting sick from it, you understand?
Yeah,
then you have to talk to somebody.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay, so sometimes happen when I see star, one time I don't feel well.
Yeah, but you didn't feel sick or
I feel sick.
Oh, that's what I was asking. Yeah.
Last month, when I see a lot of star,
I don't know what that is, but maybe be careful when you're meditating.
Really?
Yeah. Maybe you're too tired or something, and maybe you're getting.
Yeah, I'm really tired. That's time. Yeah.
Yeah, you gotta relax. Yeah.
And I also even wonder, you described before that you were very tight here.
Yeah, that's what
I think that might have something to do with it too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, by keeping it this tight. You know, that's what I was saying before when we talked. Just keep it, try to find some remedy to be more relaxed.
Relax.
You know, using the meditation earlier or finding some kind of physical therapy to help. Yeah.
Like acupuncture help too? Is it?
Yeah, that might help.
Just really keep, you can go back many times in your meditation and see what's happening here and consciously relax the muscles and loosen the jaw. You know, open your teeth.
Open.
Not so far, just open so that they're not clenched
together. Not touching.
And not touching.
Oh, sometimes so I bite.
Yeah.
When I feel something come up here,
mm-hmm.
I bite.
Yeah, well that creates lots of tension.
Really tension.
Yeah.
But I want it to come up here, but it cannot. Take long time. Yeah. Never long time. Well, sometimes when I'm not tension, it come up, but it feels really good. Mm-hmm. But this time really hard, stuck here.
Yeah.
Not come here yet.
So yeah, open the teeth.
Open
the teeth and, you know, think of just consciously relaxing all the muscles of the face. Just loosening.
Okay.
And just keep checking back over and over again. It happens so automatically when that's your habit for all of us, you know.
Really?
The jaw, the shoulders, and so if you can just keep, it doesn't have to take a lot of time. You just check back for a second and relax again.
Relax.
Thank you.
Go to the beach. Anybody else? I want to dive into this next thing here. Okay. We'll have time for more questions at the end. So what I wanted to talk about a little bit is how then does this combining practice sort of relate with Vipassana or I'm going to use the word insight meditation, because often Vipassana, I mean the word is just insight meditation. But in Tibetan Buddhism, there's a very different way of approaching Vipassana meditation. Not super different, but they use methods of analytical meditation, methods of non-analytical meditation. So we're going to kind of talk about some of that here, just so you guys, so there's a little bit more understanding of emptiness from that aspect, and then how it applies to what we've been talking about all day. But what I did want to say is the Shamatha without support, the open presence we were practicing earlier. There's a saying in Tibetan Buddhism where this is really on the, it's like on the edge or the cusp of Vipassana. So I wanted to talk a little bit about why that is. Yeah? So, it has a lot to do with spaciousness. So you saw this, we're working with combining without support. You know, it's quite challenging. So there's no sort of object that's gross that we're focusing on. We're focusing on just the awareness itself, the clarity of the mind, or the cognizance. Sometimes teachers will say bare cognizance. I like that term a lot. It's that bare awareness, yeah? Which is more subtle. Usually we're not recognizing this kind of bare awareness because we're stuck in the sort of reflection coming from that awareness. So the mind basically has ability to know. That's sort of a definition of mind within Tibetan Buddhism. So it has the ability to know, it has the ability to cognize. So it's like, it's sort of like a mirror that then reflects anything. But usually we're stuck in the reflection. we're not sort of focused in the mirror itself. So when you practice this shamatha without support, or a calm body without support, you're really focusing on that mirror itself. And what happens is you have a lot of spaciousness. A lot of spaciousness can come. A lot of also clarity can come. And then from that spaciousness, to break into Vipassana from that is almost like it's like if this sheet is wet and you just like poke a pen through it. It's sort of like that. You see? So, so this cognizance or clarity, so when we're sort of resting in this basic clarity, then when we rest in that basic clarity or basic cognizance, there's sort of an awareness and there's a gap that happens between me or I or self or sort of grasping at that, and then an outward object or a perception being other. So this is where this gap into Vipassana happens, yeah? Or into insight or emptiness. I'm going to use these synonymously, yeah? So then slowly, this is how shamatha without support can lead into Vipassana. Eventually, there has to be some awareness of what insight is or what emptiness is. And that's why in the next session I'm going to talk a little bit about one method for meditating on emptiness, which is we're going to use some analytical meditation. So I apologize if it's too cognitive, but I'm going to try to not make it too cognitive. But we need a little bit of understanding first in order to then be able to meditate on it, yeah?
Could you repeat the part about the space again?
Yeah, I'll say it in a different way. So when we're meditating just on the awareness of the mind, or just the ability to know, yeah, that bare cognizance, the more we meditate on that, more spaciousness is going to come. Just by the fact we're creating sort of a slow gap between the process of the mirror or the mind and then what's reflecting out of that, yeah? Because whatever, like, as I see you guys here and have some sort of awareness of it, of course my sense consciousness is perceiving it. But then the mind, within splits, you know, not even seconds, split moments of these, like I said, snap is like 300 and so many moments. It's taking that in, making it, other, and then at the same time labeling. And then believing that label, you see? So the process of insight meditation is to break that apart, right? I think you can tell about it same. Yeah, there's no difference. Yeah. Yeah. There's just slightly different methods in Tibetan Buddhism. And you have an array of methods from, I'm just going to explain a little bit the framework of Tibetan Buddhism so it helps. If someone were to read books or something, it'll be less confusing. Usually they're advising people to study a certain amount of material and get a very good cognitive understanding of what emptiness is, and then have a lot of logical reasonings. So then when they use analytical meditation, they're able to apply it throughout the day. It's actually quite useful, because you don't have to be in a meditative state to apply it. You're just changing the tape player of what your thoughts or how your reaction is. Does that make sense? It's not the actual experience of emptiness. It's a semblance of emptiness. But it's like sort of another way to get you to the door or to the paper, right, where you just poke the pen through. Then, within Mahamudra and Dzogchen techniques, within Tibetan Buddhism and more Vajrayana techniques, you have non-conceptual meditations on emptiness, where then a practitioner, through using investigation, analytical meditation, will have like the chops or muscle to then penetrate into a non-conceptual meditation on emptiness. I think it's very similar to Theravada, because you use investigation techniques, investigating the body, whereas the self, all these kind of things, eventually dropping into a non-conceptual meditation. Yeah. So this is loosely the process, right? So again, what comes in is this mindfulness of thoughts and emotions, what we talked about earlier. So like I said, eventually, like this spaciousness is eventually there's a distance between the thought and then the mind that is aware of the thought. So then what happens is slowly we realize, wait a second, I'm not everything I think. Or I am everything I think. You see what I'm saying? But it's not truly existing that way. Yeah? That's why the Buddha, we're going to go back to the quote here. We are what we think, and all that we are arises with our thoughts. This is saying within the first noble truth, the truth of suffering, yeah? This is the process of what's happening. Within the truth of suffering, we are what we think, and all that we are arises with our thoughts. Yeah? With our thoughts, we make the world. The world being the world of samsaric perception. If anyone's confused about that term, please let me know. Most of you know what samsara is, more or less, yeah, cyclic existence. Yeah. But the samsara is very subtle in Buddhism. I'll talk about it more when we get to the emptiness section. So then what I really want to focus on, too, in the next hour, is this: speak and act with a pure mind and happiness will follow. This is a really deceiving, actually, line. I don't know if I like the translation so much, but it doesn't matter, because we can have commentary on it and then understand it, and it doesn't matter what words they use. It does a little bit. So, mainly I have a problem with the words purity and happiness in this context. Yeah, but we'll talk about it more. But I do want to talk about it. When I read the word pure there, it sort of triggered something I wanted to start off before I get into talking about. I'm going to talk about dependent origination. It's a way to understand emptiness. A very profound, they call it the king of reasonings in Tibetan Buddhism. But it's also, I think, very accessible when you haven't heard much on emptiness yet. It's very simple. You can get something out of it right away, because it's the way we engage with phenomena normally. But before I get into that, I wanted to talk a little bit about, in Buddhism, within the Vajrayana tradition, I'm going to talk from that perspective a little bit now, the connotation is actually that we are pure. Yeah? That we're actually, in our essence, we're not flawed, we're not somehow degenerate or in need of fixing. What's going on is that we're staring at a sky and then with clouds filled in it, and we're mistaking the clouds to be the sky. But as soon as those clouds, we're able to use methods to work with those clouds, to dispel those clouds or whatever means we have to do, we're back at the ground, which is our pure being. So this is what they refer to often as Buddha nature. So I think this is a really nice way to understand emptiness, because when we understand it from this framework, we have sort of a positive aspect to spring off of as opposed to a negative. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. From some of the other jhanas from the perspective, which are beautiful. It's like these jhanas are like a gradual approach. They're like a ladder leading up. Yeah. So therefore, if you don't understand certain jhanas that have more approaches about renunciation, about the suffering nature of the world, the suffering nature of our emotions and thoughts, negative emotions and thoughts, renunciation, all that kind of thing. And then if we don't understand that, it's going to be very difficult then to have an attitude of wanting to actually recognize our Buddha nature. You see? So therefore, these kind of processes are very necessary and actually very useful. So that's why the Buddha taught this gradual approach. And then, you know, from a Tibetan Buddhist perspective, the pinnacle of this is the Vajrayana, what the Buddha taught. Yeah. So, from a Vajrayana perspective, Buddha nature is the essence of our being. And Buddha nature is something that's not flawed, it's not something that needs to be fixed, it's pure in its nature. But, right now it's covered. So again, you could look at this as two different ways. There's tons of scholars throughout Tibet and India and Sri Lanka and Thailand, everywhere, who've debated, is Buddhahood something caused or is it something that is uncaused? So you have a lot of different opinions on this, right? And who cares? I mean, you have to care a little bit because, you know, it might affect your method and your path to Buddhahood. But from the perspective I'm saying, I'm just talking from my lineage's perspective, which is that they say it's uncaused. So then, if it's uncaused, then actually it's a process of uncovering it. It's sort of like they use the analogy of a jewel buried in the mud. And the reason I'm bringing this up here, because I know some of you are Theravada, and I'm not trying to take you into another lineage or path. I'm just explaining it from this way. But also the reason I'm bringing it up is because I think this is very useful for Westerners. Because often, because of the emotional issues we have from our culture, like I mentioned earlier, self-esteem and low self-esteem is a huge issue. You know, with me, it's a huge issue. And often, sometimes, certain approaches within Buddha Dharma can hinder us if we don't look at them in the correct way. So I find that seeing the pure nature and how we actually are and what the essence of what we are is actually pure, this really helps our self-esteem. I know it helps mine, you know? So that's why I'm sort of discussing it a little bit, yeah.
I'm just curious, do the Tibetan Buddhists believe that when we are babies and we are born, aside from the karmic, bringing our karma in,
yeah,
that is a pure being, and that is our Buddha nature, and that's where we started from when we came in, and then we got programmed?
Mm,
is that,
yeah, not quite.
Do they believe that? Or?
No, I'm going to explain where the purity aspect comes from. But more or less, the Theravada, Mahayana, have to be included in Vajrayana. Vajrayana just can't be off on its own. It's taking in all the Theravada and Mahayana that are influencing your Vajrayana. So therefore, because of karma and delusion, then we're born with the five aggregates, and then we have to experience birth, old age, sickness, and death. So always the aggregates themselves are generally a cause of karma and delusion. I mean, a result of karma and delusion. Yeah. So the purity isn't coming necessarily in the body, but in Vajrayana they get into this whole thing where, because of the subtle body, it is pure in a way. So there's a lot of debate in this, but I'm speaking in general. Mm-hmm. Like more, the answer would more be that it has to do with our nature and the nature of how we actually exist. That's more where the purity is coming from. So because, I'll explain it more later, mm-hmm, but yeah, to answer your question. Mm-hmm. It's a complicated issue. We're going to talk about some complicated stuff. I saved it to the end just in case you guys hate it. And then you're gonna leave anyway. I'm just joking. No, I think you'll find it interesting. So, this idea of emptiness, right? The word emptiness, or shunyata, or in Tibetan they say tongpani, yeah? So, what are we talking about when we say emptiness? So, empty of what? Is it just emptiness, like a vacancy, or something that's sort of just like a hole in this thing? No, they're not talking about that. What it's referring to, well, the ness, actually, an emptiness, or ni in Tibetan, or ta in Sanskrit, shunyata, and has a lot of actually aspects within that. It's actually referring to the clarity aspect of knowing, but that knowing itself is not truly existent. It's not something where it's permanent, something that's permanent. It's also not something that's, what do you call it, singular, or something that we can, that is like solitary on its own, that's not interacting with something else. So this is the way I'm going to kind of lead us into emptiness here, talking about dependent origination. Basically, the fact that everything in the world, phenomena, ourselves, our mind, how we perceive, is based off of having a relationship. Everything has a relationship to something else. So then, with this, you can see that emptiness is not talking about a vacancy or like some kind of non-existence, right? But at the same time, it is questioning, okay, how do we experience our reality? How do we experience the way we perceive things, our mind projects things? How is this actually, how do we experience this? So just be real patient with me, because this topic is not easy. It's not easy to actually teach either, so... So there's three different kinds of dependent origination. There's the interdependence, and I'm going to speak about these more, and then we're going to do a little meditation on this very simple one. So this is more cognitive, like I said, right now. So there's the interdependence of cause and effect, there's the interdependence of dependent existence, and then there's the interdependence of everything being merely a conceptual designation. Right, so it's a little bit heady here, but I'm going to break it down. So the interdependence of, these all relate, they're just becoming more and more subtle. So the interdependence of cause and effect, this is why this reasoning is so helpful for us, because this is something we directly see in our life. If you plant a tomato seed, you're not going to get a chili plant. You're going to get a tomato plant, correct? So the cause correlates with the effect. Similarly, when we get angry, there's going to be a certain effect to that anger. There's a certain effect when you step in the sand with a human foot. There's going to be a human footprint or the appearance of that, yeah? Right? So this is really simple. Farmers understand this, you know, when they plant their seed, right? Then the interdependence of dependent existence, or you could say the interdependence of the way things exist, is getting a little more subtle. So within this, you have phenomena are always depending on other factors in order to exist. So this is one of the logical keys, yeah? So in order for something to exist, it actually can't be on its own. Is this clear? I can go into more explanation if I have to. I think it's clear.
Mm-hmm. Could you give an just like you did with the sea, can you give an example?
Yeah, so this cup here, in order for it to actually become something that I can drink out of and perform the function of a cup, then it has to have certain characteristics, right? The holder, or a mug, I should say, this holder, the characteristics of the cup, everything coming together. But it's dependent on all the different factors, the different, I don't know what it's made out of, but let's say
ceramic.
So all the pieces of ceramic coming together, the atoms of those pieces of ceramic coming together, what do they have it now? The Higgins God particle. You know, and then they're going to find something more small than that coming together. So all these things are coming together. You can't actually find, if you search for it, you can't actually find a point of origin of the mug. Yet the mug is here. It appears to us, and I can drink water out of it, right? So this is amazing. This is Buddha's teaching on emptiness. It's quite profound. It sounds really simple, but I'm going to get to why it's more profound and then how it affects the way we relate to our emotions, thoughts, and basically get stuck in samsara. So that's why. So it's this cup is dependent on other factors, and actually you can go even deeper than that. It's dependent on me perceiving the mug to even have the mug there. Do you see? Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Dependent on somebody making it.
Exactly.
And their family supporting them.
Yes.
And
sun and rain.
And Jill putting water in here, you know, and bringing it to me, or whatever. You know, there's so many different factors. Yes, sun, rain, all the different factors that come in this. Yeah? I mean, it's endless. It's actually endless. So then here's a reasoning that we're going to come back to a little bit. I don't want to get too much. This is more going to the logical side of Tibetan Buddhism, or scholastic, intellectual side. I don't want to go too much into it, but I'm mentioning a little bit here. So more or less, the interdependence of dependent existence, or the interdependence of the way things exist, the reason things are existent in this way is because of phenomena. You can't actually find any phenomena in the world. Our bodies, our minds, wood, cups, whatever the phenomena, sky, water, that is singular, independent, or permanent. Yeah? But actually, so through these, we refute existence, but then we also, through these, we refute, like a permanent, singular, independent existence, but at the same time, they're not non-existent. See? And the whole reason they're not non-existent is because they're singular, independent, and permanent. It's very interesting. So it works both ways.
Say that again.
Yeah. I'm going to repeat this a lot, okay, because it's a little bit of a head trip. So because phenomena, and by phenomena, when I use the phenomena in Buddhism means everything that appears. They use the word nama in Tibetan, which means all appearances. Appearances that are external, like cups and houses and people and everything, and also internal appearances like thoughts and emotions. Those are all phenomena. Yeah.
We call that Dhamma.
You know, Dhamma.
That's Dhamma. Dhamma.
Dhamma.
With a small D.
Yeah. Dharma, you can call it. In statement to Tibetan Buddhism, they use the word Dharma to say that too. Yeah. Actually in the four foundations of mindfulness, you have the mindfulness of Dharma, which is...
That's the big thing.
That's what it is, yeah. So then, what was I saying? So phenomena are not singular, independent, or permanent. And then because they're not singular, independent, or permanent, you can't find actually something that exists if you search for it. I'm just talking about logic. But obviously we have to get to this kind of way through experience. That's the difficult part. This is not hard. But because it's not singular, independent, or permanent, it exists. It can function. I can drink out of it. It appears. You see? So this is sort of what we call the Buddha's lion's roar. This was his pinnacle of his teaching on emptiness. Yeah.
The how and why and how is it empty? Can you bring it back to how and why?
How is it practical?
Is it empty? Is it empty?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We're going to go into that. Okay. So it's empty because it's dependent.
Okay.
Yeah. So because something's dependent, you can't actually... I mean, just a really simple way... I'm kind of making it more complicated, but a really simple way is when you break something down into its parts, you can't actually find something there.
So it's empty.
Okay. Yeah. So then it doesn't exist as something solid. Usually we're taking our emotions, we're taking our thoughts to be some kind of solidly existing, independent, permanent, singular thing. The Four Noble Truths actually function because things are not independent, singular, or permanent. You know?
Does it exist apart from our creation of it? Our knowledge of it?
Different schools would say different things.
We could take something like this. We have a name for this, a concept. If we start taking it apart, I don't think this will come out. But, you know, you can see if you take all the pieces apart and you lay them out there and you say, is this a pen?
Mm-mm.
And, you know, if I could have taken this out, you can say, is that a pen? Ink, what holds the ink?
Cartridge.
The cartridge? Maybe I can get them apart. I think I do.
Okay.
Look at that. Okay, now, you know, is that the pen? Is this the pen? Is this the pen? That means they're dependent on one another to function as a pen. But they have no singular, independent, permanent penness to them.
Yeah.
And this is a whole lot simpler than when you take yourself apart.
Yeah, we're gonna do that though too. We're gonna do a really brief meditation on it because, in my opinion, Tibetans like to talk about the cup and all this kind of thing. That's really helpful when you're trying to understand it, but in practical experience, really we're trying to apply it to our own five aggregates. Yeah?
Say the five aggregates, please.
Yeah.
Form, feeling, compositional factors. Consciousness, I always forget one.
Perception.
Okay.
Form, feeling, perception.
That's complicated.
Mental formation and consciousness.
Yeah, mental formation.
Consciousness.
Yeah, exactly. But basically, I mean, I just simplify it when I meditate, and I'm going to simplify it here today. Just body and mind, more or less. It's very simple.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Can't get it back together. It's never. It's no longer a pen.
So then, this third type of interdependence, the interdependence of everything being merely a conceptual designation. This is going even more so. That actually, in order for something exists because we're designating it, but it's a mere designation. So it's not that things don't exist. It's okay to have. There's a mere cup. That's how this exists. It exists as a mere cup. But once we say it's a cup, and then we get all sorts of judgment, this cup is blue, and I hate blue. I don't like this color, aqua blue, you know? I don't like this handle, I wish it was bigger, or something like that, or I wish it didn't have a handle, right? And there's all sorts of trappings we're creating. That's when karma and delusion are coming into it, yeah? The whole purpose of emptiness is to get out of karma and delusion, you know? To stop creating karma, and actually to... What do you call it? Cut off delusion, and then you don't create karma anymore. That's how you become enlightened being, you know? I mean, with a lot of other factors, but more or less that's how it works. So this interdependence of everything being merely a conceptual designation. So, again, I was talking about a subject-object, where we have someone, myself, seeing the cup, labeling it, having the appearance of the cup. But then, I'm not having the experience of the mere cup. Actually, a yogi... See, this is where I think emptiness gets tricky for people, because some people then get into this a little bit of a nihilistic attitude, or they get into an eternalist attitude. There's these two extremes. So the nihilist attitude is thinking, oh, well, this cup is empty, so who cares? I'm just going to throw it across the room. Yeah, you could do that, but it's actually negating its mere existence. So it has a mere cupness. It functions as a cup. It can appear, we can use it. So that's what respecting the relative aspect. So again, going back to this dance of the relative and ultimate, we're respecting the relative. But at the same time, if we respect the relative too much, then, oh, I love this cup, This cup is the best cup. I hate all your cups. Cups can go to hell. Take them out of here. You see what I'm saying? We get into all this judgment and trouble and all kinds of emotional grasping around something. Is this semi-clear? Mm-hmm. Yeah? So dependent origination, eliminating the extreme of existence. So again, I explained how dependent origination, and Jill had a nice example there, where this is how we refute the extreme of existence. Because when you actually investigate something, whether it's your aggregates or table or a cup, you're not going to be able to find it. You're going to be, it'll appear to you, the appearance will never go away, but you won't be able to find the cupness. You see? Yeah, we're clear on that? Mm-hmm. So then dependent origination, eliminating the extreme of non-existence. Here, even though we can break down this cup, and we can't actually find a cup, no matter how hard we try, with logic I'm saying, and then in other cases, experience, we won't be able to find one either. Even though we can't find, an arhat can't find any kind of cup here. I'm not saying I'm an arhat, but if an arhat were here, he wouldn't, or he or she would not be able to find a cup there. But the cup would still appear. You see what I'm saying?
No.
So, because it's dependent on parts, and because all these parts are dependently arising in a formation that functions as a cup appears. Right? And then we can interact with a cup, we can drink from it, all that. So it's not non-existent. There's always an appearance happening. For instance, when we go to sleep, there's an appearance. When we faint, there's still an appearance, but it's not the appearance of what we normally think of as phenomena. It's the appearance, the black appearance of faint. You know? When we're meditating, there's an appearance happening. There's thoughts coming through. When we're in a state of non-thought, there's still the appearance. It's an appearance of non-thought. You see what I'm saying? So there's always appearance. The mind, when the mind is knowing, there's always this appearance that the mind is going to have. But again, when we get stuck in that appearance and then reify that appearance and then think of it as singular, and then we feel it's not like we think of it, it's a root feeling of it being permanent or independent. When this feeling is there, then this appearance sort of solidifies. So they have this example also of water and ice. So it's like ice is the nature of water, but it's water that's become frozen. So that's normally what happens to us with appearances, with thoughts and emotions. The water of thoughts and emotions, of appearances, have become solidified into us because we believe them, we've reified them. Yeah?
Conceptual instantiation.
What is it?
It's sort of a conceptual instantiation.
Yeah. Yes. There's one level, this is where you have the cognitive and emotional obscurations. So in order to become an enlightened being, you have these two aspects. The cognitive, I'm more really saying they're the conceptual designation. So an arhat realizes that. When they realize the selflessness of... This is from a Tibetan perspective, right? So I'm just saying that clearly. Not saying it's right or the best, I'm just saying this is the one I know. So then when an arhat realizes the selflessness of person, they actually eliminated the cognitive obscurations, which have to do with conceptual designation. They're not seeing an independently existing iPad or table anymore. They're not interacting it like that. But it's on a deep feeling level. It's not just the intellectual level. But then a Buddha has gone further to actually shed away the emotional obscurations. And the emotional obscurations are much, much deeper. And the emotional obscurations have to actually deal with this, something they call convergent ignorance, or it's a type of ignorance that's like in almost, it's not innate, because like I said, Buddha nature is our nature. Like, the Buddha potential is our nature. This ground of being, of emptiness, is our nature. But because of obscurations, then it's almost like there's like this innate grasping at things being independent. So those are the emotional obscurations. Yeah? This is getting into more heady stuff. But still, it's helpful, I think. So a really good example is like a rainbow. So again, instead of, similar to Jill's pen, a rainbow, it appears, if you have the right conditions that come together, sunlight, moisture, right? And then you're standing, and I'm sure more conditions than that, and you're standing in a certain way to see the rainbow, you're going to see a rainbow, and the colors all appear the same. Every rainbow you see, they have an order to the way the rainbow appears. But then when you go and you try to look at it, there's nothing. You know? It's just transparent. So this is a really good analogy they also like to use to explain how phenomena actually are. When the conditions come together to create something, it'll appear. But then at the same time, it's almost like this transparent thing. But of course, I mean, I can walk on this floor. But it doesn't really matter. Just because it's more material doesn't mean it's any less empty than a rainbow. You see? A rainbow is just a really good example because it's something we have a physical relationship with that's more transparent. I'd like to do a meditation on this. That might help you guys. But we can have some questions.
There was something I heard when I was 17 because I had read the Richard Brautigan book. And when I first got to college and was this professor who was, I guess, a Buddhist, but he said that if you shoot an arrow to a wall, the arrow does not exist, the wall doesn't even exist, and the floor doesn't exist. And it finally took me a while to figure out what he was talking about. He said, because everything I just said was in the past, and everything I'm going to say will be in the future, so it's so difficult to accept the present because it's constantly moving. So he said there is no floor, there is no wall, there is no arrow going through because it's moving. So is that any sort of a concept as well, where it's going from past, present to future so quickly that there's no solidity to it? It doesn't really exist, even though of course I'm saying it exists, but he's saying no, it doesn't, because it's going through time.
Yeah, I mean, impermanent, that would be sort of impermanence.
Impermanence. Oh, yeah. Maybe that's where that comes from.
I mean, so impermanence. Yeah, I mean, for instance, like this floor appears to us right now as something very solid, and to me it appears very permanent. But actually the atoms within it are always moving, and it's not static.
Right.
Same with us, you know? It's almost like, I wanted to say this, and then Julie said something. This is really interesting, actually. I'm glad I remembered I was going to write it. No, I almost forgot. If you notice, throughout our lives, we're sort of recreating our persona every so often. And then that persona sort of exhausts itself, and then we create a new persona. In a way, we're kind of creating a persona every day. But, a really beautiful meditation to do, we're going to work with it a little bit in a meditation, but think back to when you're a baby, as much as you can, and then the small child, and then all these different sort of ways of feeling, I am here, or I am this. And you'll see how many we've created throughout our life. You see? And you'll see that actually what we think is us is just a creation of our thoughts. And it's just a creation. I'm not saying we don't exist. Don't get me wrong. We do. You know, if you jump off a bridge, you will die. You know, your body will die. Right? But at the same time, these personas we create are our mind's creation. And then we believe them to be that. And then we have all sorts of suffering and I'm this, and this person's like this, they're not like me, so, you know what I'm saying? With all these trips around it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a very direct way of understanding this. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Julie, you had something?
No, I think I'll pass.
Okay. So I'd like to do a short little meditation. Not, I think we've talked a lot on this. And then I want you guys to talk a little bit in small groups, and then we can have some question answer and sort of wrap it up a little bit. We're almost out of time. This is going to be short, I promise. So just slowly bring your attention back to your body. I think the focus here, we started with mindfulness of body, and we'll just keep going back to that. That's sort of our root, our groundedness. So then just turn your attention inwards. We're going to use our analysis a little bit now, our cognitive aspect of our mind. So how are we perceiving ourselves at this moment? Are we associating with a certain thought, an emotion, a sensation in our body? Maybe we're tired and want to just go lay down. Or maybe it's a combination of these. combination of thoughts, emotions, feelings. So just take a note of how you're perceiving yourself in this present moment. Basically, your physical and mental faculties, the five aggregates. So are we perceiving ourselves as one entity? Is it all sort of globbed into one? Are we perceiving as multiple things? How are the combination of thoughts, sensations, feelings working together? This is very subtle. So is the combination of thoughts, sensations, and feelings related? Are they different? Again, what I just mentioned, we can meditate on that a little bit. So how much have we changed over the years? Not only our body, but also our relationship with ourselves, with how we view the world, how we view our place in the world, whether we view ourselves as strong, weak, sick, not sick, invincible, feminine, masculine, good, bad. Just reflect on even certain times in your life. Especially a time when that was really different than how you are now, or how you perceive yourself now. For instance, for me, it's late childhood, preteen. So then ask yourself the question, does this mean we have many selves? So if we're separate from our body and mind, do we experience something outside of our body and mind? Have we ever had that kind of experience? And if we're one with our body and mind, how is it that we've had so many different experiences of how that body and mind express itself? Also, if you break down the parts of our body, our physical aggregates as well as our mental aggregates, where can you actually find an I or a self? When these come together, we have a mirror, a mirror self. But is this how we normally perceive ourselves? So just reflect on the fact that we exist in dependence upon many factors coming together. The food we eat, the habitual patterns we've developed in this life, how we were raised, educational system, the environment, the air we breathe, our thoughts and emotional patterns are based off the previous moments. Just reflect on how dependent we really are. So if there's so if we exist independence, why is there then a need to reify a concept of ourselves that exists independently? Why is it that we just don't dwell in the mere I, or the fact that we dependently exist? We really have to investigate this deeply. Is this just a thought pattern, an emotion, or something deeper that's holding this view of independence? So when it comes to the I, in Buddhism there's a type of conventional I. Though this I isn't reified, it's a mere designation. This we call the mere I. So if things don't exist independently, and they don't have any kind of inherent existence, they exist like a dream, a mirage, an illusion. And does this dreamlike existence benefit or harm us? Yes, it does. If this dreamlike existence didn't affect us, then we could say that phenomena don't exist at all. Although it is empty in essence, therefore it can affect us. Therefore we have to respect the interdependence of cause and effect. So when you do analytical meditation, I'm going to let you guys reflect for a minute or two. Just reflect on this really simple reasoning. Breaking our body and mind into parts. And when we're not able to actually find where an I resides, just rest in that feeling of not finding. So we're not continuing the analysis infinity. We're continuing the analysis until a deep feeling of not finding that I arises. When the not finding comes, we just rest in that not finding. And when we get distracted again, we continue the analysis and rest again when we come to a conclusion. Use whatever analysis you have in your life and practical experience. On this for a minute or two. And I want you to open your eyes and sort of continue this meditation with your sense consciousnesses open. You can use your hearing, sights, sensations. Look around as if everything you're seeing is dependently arisen. It's based off causes and conditions. There are many parts that make up the phenomena that we see, that we hear. We're not denying that they exist. We're seeing them like a rainbow, like a dream, an illusion. Slowly this breaks apart through a lot of meditation on this. Our clinging to things as independent, as permanent. The lessons are grasping. And eventually as this meditation becomes a non-conceptual meditation, will cut the root of samsara itself, and the root of grasping. Great yogi Tolopa said to Naropa, great Indian saints, not phenomena that bind us to samsara, it's the clinging that binds us. So cut your clinging through seeing its nature. So now we're at the end of this verse here. Speak and act with a pure mind and happiness will follow. So, I'm going to interpret this from what we were just talking about. So, when you have a pure mind, or you're relating with the ground of being, which is your own Buddha nature, and you're coming closer to that, the ground of being, or of our Buddha nature, is emptiness. It's this fact that things do not exist independently, singular or permanent, yeah? And they're always in a state of dance of the relative and ultimate is dancing together. So therefore, when we're in that state and we're coming closer to that state of purity, and the purity here isn't some puritanical type of purity. The purity is when we're able to rest or be with the nature of reality, things that are extraneous to the nature of reality just fall away. So there's actual purity. Yeah? This is like real purity, not purity that's created or sort of like something composed. It's purity coming off of seeing the nature itself. So once this purity is seen, any kind of speech and action we'll have will create actual long-lasting true happiness, which is actually the abandonment of happiness, which is Buddhahood. It's the abandonment of happiness, not in the sense of, because there's no happiness, there's a lot of bliss, but in the sense that there's, we're not looking for any kind of temporary, momentary happiness. The root of suffering is sort of cut off forever, and therefore there's happiness. Yeah? I like this quote. So, we don't have too much time, so I was thinking maybe instead of small group, we just talk all together, and we can just discuss, we can do question and answer, just to finish up. Anything you guys want to talk about throughout the day. You know, this was maybe a little bit challenging, but I felt like presenting it at the end, you know, a little bit. And this is something very deep, this topic that takes a lot of thinking on, meditating on, and this is one method to use to get that things. There's also many, many other methods. Yeah? This is just one method I wanted to present. Oh, yeah.
I understand conceptually the concept of emptiness and pin and origination, but I don't really feel it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's just a process of a lot of working with it, practicing it over years, and then continuing that. And I think eventually finding methods that are help to drop into a non-conceptual understanding of emptiness really help with this. Because what they do is then you have the support of a little, some study, some understanding on a conceptual level, and then by using analytical meditation like we just did, you're going to have some experience with that if you persevere with that kind of analytical meditation. But then the experience is limited because it's on a conceptual level. But it really helps still. But then if we have some experience with a non-conceptual type meditation, they really support each other. So I think I was having a lot of trouble as well, and I still do with this kind of meditation using analysis. But I tell you, if you work with it, and it's something you have to apply in the session breaks. In the session breaks, you do more of the style what I said at the end, which is you try to view things like a dream, a mirage. But because it's dreamlike, it doesn't mean it won't. The relative doesn't exist. If you walk in front of a dreamlike car, you will be dreamlike hit. You see what I'm saying? So, you know, it's not referring to that. It's just meaning it's referring to things having this illusory appearance, where they appear so solid to us and so permanent and so, you know, on their own. But actually, they don't exist that way when you interact with them. You see, so this analytical style is one way to break that down. Basically, any meditation within Buddhism working with emptiness, whether it's coming from Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana, Dzogchen, whatever, it's trying to break down the way we're perceiving things as solid and real. But if the method's not working, then you have to try some other methods. Not every method is necessarily applicable to every single person. That's why the Buddha has many different methods. But I think also we have to persevere a little bit sometimes. I think that's something for you to figure out. But I definitely found a combination of Dzogchen style Mahamudra, or you can use Vipassana techniques from Theravada, non-conceptual techniques, really supporting the analytical techniques as well. Yeah. Mm-hmm. To help them?
I don't know what non-conceptual techniques might be, except for, you know, back in the 80s they dropped acid, you know.
That's definitely a non-conceptual technique. I don't know if it's one that'll be lasting, but it will. Dzogchen practice, Mahamudra practice from the Tibetan traditions. Generally, they have techniques where you're doing Vipassana meditation, but there's no analysis. Due to some factors from the teacher, some blessings, also the method you're practicing with that teacher, you have a chance of recognizing a non-conceptual state of mind, a non-conceptual type of emptiness. So, but I think combining these, you have to combine these. That's why, at least in the Tibetan tradition, this is how they teach it. You're combining the scholarship, I don't know, maybe there's a better word for that. Certainty, intellectual certainty, or cognitive certainty, you're combining that with non-conceptual certainty, which comes from meditation where you're just, you're not doing it, performing an analysis with thoughts. I it's hard to get into it here, but more or less that's the general explanation. Yeah? You can check out books, you can also, you really have to find a teacher for that kind of thing. But also I think, these techniques work in the Theravada. If you use the Vipassana techniques, I think they can definitely lead you to the selflessness of persons, for sure. They can lead you to emptiness if you persevere with them. Yeah. So often, sometimes we don't give these things a lot of time, and then we expect results. Or sometimes they take a lot of time, and also factors. This is what I was saying, the tool belt. Often we need a lot of things. We need the collection. In Tibetan Buddhism, they call the collection of merit and purification. But in Theravada, I think they have the same thing, where you're keeping precepts, you're avoiding certain behavior, you're working on your samadhi practice, then also you're doing vipassana practice, and then you know, they also have the paramis, you're creating generosity. These all create more conditions to have the experience come. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So there's many ways to break down this grasping. Actually, it's so beautiful. The more you study Dharma, the more you see every method the Buddha taught was aimed at breaking down this perception of a solidly existent self and solidly existent phenomena. Every single method, from metta practice through generosity practice, vipassana, samadhi, these all are aimed at that. It's quite beautiful, actually. It's really inspiring. So you can see the pinnacle of Buddha Dharma is this emptiness meditation to actually cut the root of the tree. All these other methods are working on the branches, but of course it's going to help, and it's going to get you closer to cutting the root of the tree. Yeah? Like, for instance, metta meditation. When you're growing your loving kindness and compassion for others, yourself, your own self-cherishing attitude is becoming less and less important. Therefore, you're going to have a lot less grasping and worry about your own emotions. Therefore, you're going to be closer to emptiness. I'm not saying add emptiness, but it's going to move you in that direction. You see? So we need all these kind of tools. Yeah? Anybody else? Don't be scared. We only got 15 more minutes.
Well, I just found that my mind didn't want to go there.
Yes.
You know, yeah. I don't know if it's practice that wouldn't work for me, and or is not something that would move me along, mm-hmm. or if I just need to persevere a little more.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is just sort of an introduction to it. Mm-hmm. Also, in order to do this kind of practice, usually it's assuming you have a lot of background in a certain style. Usually, someone will study a lot of textual scriptural material and then practice this. But I think this can also be done in a simple way without a lot of background. Mm-hmm. Again, I think this is counter to our nature, because usually we're using analytical meditation. We use analytical meditation all day long, but we're usually not using it in this kind of way. So it's sort of like, it's the same muscle, but it's like the bicep versus the tricep. We're normally working our bicep, like, oh, if I eat this avocado and turkey sandwich, then I shouldn't have cheese. Or, you know, that's analytical meditation. Mm-hmm. Really, really. This is all analytical. All day long we're doing this. Oh, this car has, you know, if we're buying a new car, this car has this features, this car, and then we're checking them out. You know, this computer has this features, this computer has this features. Oh, okay. You know, we're doing this kind of thing all day, but we're not used to applying it to the kind of topic here. Mm-hmm. So then again, it's like the muscle, but it's this flabby muscle that I never work out. Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah? So, but I think it, go real easy, you know, because the reason I wait till the end to present this too is, generally, we have an overly analytical, intellectual culture. So often, by the time most of us reach an age where we're interested in the Dharma, we've been intellectualized out. Actually, the reason we came to the Dharma is because we think it doesn't have analytical or intellectualism, but it has so, so much. So I think, in that case, we have to find a way to approach it with a lot of openness. And that's why I'm suggesting a combination of more non-conceptual meditations, or it could just be like palm-biting practice, samadhi practice, more sitting-style meditations where you're not doing a lot of analysis with the mind, combining those with some analysis but done very well in with very good techniques, you see? And then we slowly, through learning, what happens is we get inspired. So we see, wow, that's really interesting. And then we want to sort of use the analysis in that way. And then it grows. But I think for us, it's much better if it comes naturally, like that. But so, yeah, that would be my advice. But, yeah. My sister's trying to come in, but it's the wrong way. Usually does that. Okay. I think she figured it out. Okay, yeah.
I have one more question.
Sure, yeah.
And this is kind of like my big obstacle to understanding emptiness, is that I do have a sense of continuity from since I was a child to the present. Of course,
yeah.
Changes, you know.
Of course, yeah.
Changes in appearance, changes in action and stuff. But I do have this sense that myself is the contours and boundaries of is my body.
Yeah.
Is the definition of myself.
Yeah.
Whatever else is going on.
Yeah.
So, and I'm sure that Buddhism has a response to that.
Oh yeah, I mean that's like the when we're in, that's like the biggest grasping is usually towards our body. Mm-hmm. So then there's sort of an identification with the body. Mm-hmm. But again, what I was trying to get at, we're using analytical methods, but it's very hard. You have to do this a lot in order to hit the root of what we're actually, where we feel this I, because it's almost like innate. Like for instance, if you put fire in your hand, it runs the other way. Every sentient being has this. It's almost like this survival instinct. So the eye is almost, it's like a gut reaction. You see what I'm saying? So that's why this kind of obscuration, it usually doesn't shed until very later, much later in the path. So the path is sort of slowly eroding this more and more. But yeah, Buddhism, it would just say that's sort of the innate grasp. The body is sort of the thing we grasp at the most as our sort of who we are and sort of our base.
Obscuration, that's good.
I think that one of the ways that we, in our Theravadan approach, our Vipassana approach, that we can approach this, or at least it certainly has been available to me, is through, I mean, the three aspects that we seem to be fooled by is we think we're permanent, we think we're singular, and we think we're independent. So the impermanence piece is, I think, a way that we can, if we start to really pay attention to all of our experiences,
yeah.
if we have emotion and we're willing, you know, a strong, powerful emotion that we're identified with, I'm an angry person or I'm a depressed person or whatever, but we really start to sense into our experience of that, without the words, just our sense of what that is, it starts to flow. We start to see that we're a process. We're not this fixed, permanent thing that we think we're. Our thoughts, certainly, we know that. I mean, if we don't cling to our thoughts, they arise and they pass. Mm-hmm. We probably all experienced some of that today when we were doing the Vipassana without the samadhi without support. And even the body, I mean, the body, experience of the body, when you're really concentrated on it, is nothing more than a bunch of tingles and vibrations and flowing heats and pains that come and go, and there isn't much permanent there. So I find impermanence a real solid way for me to get into this no self as thing. And so
I think that's
how, in our practice. That's,
yeah, I think that's how Theravada practitioners become arahats, is through refining this impermanence meditation subtler and subtler and subtler until the realization of emptiness comes through that.
Yeah, and that's a lot of what Jill and I are actually teaching in this course, is just ways to focus. Ways to focus on your experience of emotional states, your experience of thoughts that are in verbal form, your experience of thoughts that are in mental form, your experience of the body, visual form, and your sense of body, of your sensations in the body. So the more you refine your ability to really pay attention to that, the more impermanence you see at a deep level.
There are lots of examples, too, of not feeling separate from others. When you have a feeling for someone, you know, the connection between a mother and a child, the connection between you and your favorite pet, you don't feel separate.
Mm-hmm.
You're interconnected. You're related, and so that's an easy one for some to understand that you're not. You're in relationship.
Yeah. Anyone else have any? We've got a few minutes. Yeah.
I found this all very challenging. My head's spinning a little bit. I think I have a question, and I think this is the right way to ask it. You know, you're talking about, you know, the cup and objects and the self and I'm approaching what you're saying, but then I think of other things that feel like a real universe, like love or compassion, and where do things like that fit in with this?
Yeah, I mean, they're similar. Again, I think this is why emptiness is quite difficult to understand, because eventually we get to what's called like the union of appearance and emptiness. So this is really difficult to understand, more and more difficult to meditate on. So that's what I'm saying. Just give yourselves a lot of space, because this is not easy when you hear it for the first time. It's not an easy thing to grasp. So it's not denying that something can't be there or exist or be of benefit. For instance, like this, you know, the water, the cup that I said doesn't exist independently, and the water that's in it still quenches my thirst and helps my body to thrive. I need the water. The very fact that it's empty, actually, if things were not sort of empty or things were independent, nothing would function. You see? Things would just come to a complete standstill. Things would just be frozen. So it's the very fact that they're not independent, that they're in independence upon each other, that everything can function. Similarly, with compassion, loving kindness, those can function. Also, the Four Noble Truths can function. Buddhahood can happen because things are not inherently existent and they're empty in nature. Yeah, it's very tricky, but there's no other way to really explain it. Something you've got to just think about. Also, you have to read. Check out different books. I mean, I really suggest Dalai Lama books. They're like the best for understanding this. They're really, really good. But so I don't know if that answered, but it's getting there. So yeah, there's no denial of compassion or loving kindness, and or Buddhahood or anything like that. I mean, the qualities of Buddhahood or the quality of Buddha nature, you could say, is compassion and loving kindness. The whole reason why, the things that are extraneous or to the quality or the pure nature of being, emptiness, are the kleshas. They are the negative emotions. You see? The grasping onto things as something independent. These are the things that are actually extraneous. So, for instance, you can see that because so many meditators have gone through the path, become arhats, become bodhisattvas, become buddhas. And when they become that, it's not like they're, of course they went through a path and they progressed on a path and did samadhi practice, did all these different meditations, vipassana practice to achieve that impermanence. But at the same time, what was extraneous to the ground of being is synonymous here with emptiness, what was extraneous to that, shed away. So it shows you what actually is part of the nature reality, but the qualities that come out of being an arhat, being a Buddha, being a Bodhisattva, are great compassion, great loving kindness, the ability to benefit others fully, you see? So you can see those qualities are actually sort of innate within Buddha nature. It's interesting that way. Yeah. So it's kind of getting more out of your question, maybe.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a deep question. This is very deep stuff, so it's a little challenging to present it at 5 o'clock after a long day. But I think I didn't want to present it earlier because I didn't want you to think so much early on. I wanted to get more to the emotions.
You wanted to send us home.
Again, I'd also advocate all the meditations that I taught leading up to this are to prepare you to then work with this. So if you then abandon the meditations that I previously taught, you're going to get stuck in this one, and it's going to drive you a little nuts, because we tend to use our analysis to create stress for ourselves in this country. So that's what I'm saying. Rest in your body, you know, use some samadhi practice, and just very gently think about this. Don't push yourself. Also, what Jill said, you know, it's okay to not understand. Being confused is actually a really good thing. You know?
Yeah. Someone gave me a book many years ago, and it's by the Dalai Lama, and has pictures, which is really nice. And the title of it is A Simple Path.
Yeah.
So So I opened it and I started reading it and I thought, no, it's something, so I put it away and I tried it again and now I'm going to try it again. And it started to get really deep and I thought, why would they call it a simple path to bring me in, or is there a, I know there's volumes of books written about this. And because we're human and we have this mind and we can't. I'm just curious if you have a thought about a simple path. Because I've heard you say also sometimes it's simple, but.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Yeah, if anybody has to leave, we'll probably stop, and we'll stop after this question. Why is it simple? I don't know why they titled that book A Simple Path. You know, I've never seen that one in particular.
Okay, yeah.
Simple and easy aren't the same.
Yes.
Right, that's what I mean.
Simple might mean clear. Mm-hmm. Easy means not difficult to do.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they say it's simple to follow your breath. It's very clear, but it's
exactly.
not easy.
That's what I was saying earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, conceptually, this is a little bit difficult to understand, but I don't know if that book had a lot of things like this in it, did it?
No, not this stuff.
Yeah.
To talk about what Tibetan Buddhism was.
Yeah, I mean, in essence, it is a simple path. But then again, according to people's karmic dispositions and habitual patterns, of course it may be extremely difficult for some people, not simple. And I think that's why I was saying, sometimes it's good, we have to strip things down and just have a simple way of approaching things first, but then we have to become more open. And then also be willing to be confused, be willing to not know, you know, and just explore. I think this factor is getting lost more in the culture as well, of like not being okay with not knowing. And it's really important. I mean, I think it's really a precious thing. I mean, Jill will teach on it probably, but she was talking a lot about that, about this kind of space of not knowing being such a rich space of exploration. I mean, I know for myself, I think, and probably many of us in this room, the not knowing sort of led us to the spiritual path, more or less. But then we want to know everything and get the spiritual path in our pocket and get the iPad app and everything. And then we're like, okay, now I'm good. Now I can die happy. But actually, we didn't really get the essence. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not saying anybody. This is other people, not in this room. This is people over in that meditation place over there. So, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Beautiful. Thank you.
So, thank you guys. It's been really fun today. I really enjoyed doing it. You guys have been really, really attentive. It was a long day. A lot of information. I want to thank Jill and Bruce for inviting me. That's really kind of you guys. Yeah, that's about it from my side. I think that maybe we have some dedication prayers to say, and then do you guys have any announcements or that's
no.
it? Okay. So these are the prayers after the teachings. So again, like I explained in the morning, these are aspiration prayers as well as we're dedicating sort of all the virtue, all the energy, we put into meditation and listening and understanding today, we're dedicating it to our own enlightenment for the benefit of others. You see? So then it becomes an actual potential that will ripen in the future. This is not just empty words. Yeah?
Samadhi Tantra Sipani Tarni Nipedranam Panchene Keganashi Balam Trupayi Sipe Sole Drowan Drowosho. By this merit may we obtain omniscience, having defeated the enemy's wrongdoings. May we liberate all beings from the ocean of existence with its stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death. Jamju Sancho Rinpoche Make Panam Gegurche Kepa Nampa Meparyam Kone Kondu Kawarsho. May the precious Bodhicitta arise where it has not arisen, and where it has arisen may it not decay, but it increase further and further. Kone Tawa Rinpoche Make Panam Gegurche Kepa Nyampa Meparyam Kone Kondu Kawarsho. May the precious view of emptiness arise where it has not arisen, and where it has arisen may it not decay, but increase further and further. Shabba Sambe Rinpoche, Ma Kepa Nam Ke Gurchen, Kepa Nyampa Mepayan, Kone Kongu Pavorcho. May the precious conduct of non-violence arise where it has not arisen, and where it has arisen may it not decay, but increase further and further.
So now you can just take a second and you can dedicate to anything you want to dedicate. Any family, friends who may be sick, you want to send the merit we've created here to them, the good virtue we've created. Also, we need more peace in the world, so we're dedicating this merit for all wars to end, all unjust wars to end. Beings decaying and beings, so that beings may be able to gain the ability for whatever they wish in accord with the Dharma. Thanks so much. Have a good evening.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.